This is Steve Kim. Welcome to the AC Podcast. On this podcast, we want to help you understand and speak the language of our culture and address questions being asked with intellectual honesty, gentleness, and respect. One of my favorite parts of the Apologetics Canada conference, for me, actually comes after the time of the conference itself, where I get to sit down and edit through all the audio recordings from the breakout sessions. Now, while all the sessions are fantastic, every now and then I come across a talk that makes me go, I wish everybody could hear this, whether they actually purchase the conference recordings or not. So, on today's edition of AC Podcast, you'll get to hear from Jenny Konkin, the president and co-founder of the Holway House Society that operates in downtown Eastside in Vancouver, British Columbia. Now, if you're from outside of this area and you're not familiar with Vancouver, downtown Eastside in Vancouver has a very high concentration of homelessness, drug addiction, and so on and so forth. It's a very rough part of the town, and it contains the poorest postal code in Canada. Now, I strongly want to encourage you listeners to consider giving to Holway House. You can do that by going to their website, holwayhouse.ca, wholewayhouse.ca, and you can click the donate button. And if you like what you hear, we have more resources like this one. So you can go to our website, apologeticscanada.com, and click on the store button, and you can check out other resources that we have there. Well, I am going to just get out of the way here and let Jenny do the talking. I hope you enjoy this talk as much as I did. You're listening to Compassion Precedes Action, Applying Jesus' Model of Healing to Healing the Brokenhearted of Our Cities by Jenny Konkin. Jenny is president and co-founder of the Holway House Society in Vancouver, British Columbia. This breakout session was recorded at the 2019 Apologetics Canada Conference on March 2nd at Northview Community Church in Abbotsford, British Columbia. For more resources, please visit us at apologeticscanada.com.
All right. Are we ready? Yeah? Okay. For the recording's sake, my name is Jenny Konkin. I'm the president and co-founder of Holway House Society, and this is session two of How Compassion Precedes Action. I want to tell you a little bit about Holway House today and what we do in the downtown east side, how we got started, and my journey of understanding how God used compassion to heal people, and what I believe we've found is helping to heal people in the downtown east side in the community that we work in. I'll start at the beginning. I was working in the restaurant industry, and I was climbing my little corporate ladder, thinking I was pretty good. I was all accomplished. And in 2009, my 48-year-old healthy father was diagnosed with terminal melanoma. He was given 4 months to live, which was very shocking. I was definitely a daddy's girl. Grew up with a great father. I was very blessed. And in that time, my family came together. We, you know, when you're given this terminal diagnosis, what do you do? And actually, I remember saying, Dad, we're going to quit our jobs. Let's go traveling. What do you want to do? And he's like, what do I do? Just sit here and like wait to die? He's like, I already do what I love. My parents have a great marriage and relationship ministry. He's like, no, we're going to keep on living. He's like, yeah, let's, you know, let's have some family time. That's great. But we're living on purpose as it is. And so that was a big life lesson for me is if you got a diagnosis today, are you doing what you love to do or what you is on purpose for you in your life? And so but I did decide to leave my career. When you work in a restaurant industry, you're pretty much married to that restaurant. So I went to work with my parents, helping them with their ministry, as well as my grandparents have low-income housing buildings in the downtown east side. They bought them in the 70s, and throughout all my life my parents had worked there, my grandparents, and so, but my brother and I, we both decided to do it together. We're going to go manage these buildings. 85 units, low income, guys coming in off the streets, out of prison, and we're like, we're bright kids, we're really successful, we can fix this, what's the big deal, right? I don't just want to be a building manager, I want to save the downtown east side. We're going to help them get clothes and food, and I can even help write resumes, and we'll get them jobs. And I think God was probably looking down on us going, you're so cute, that's a good idea, kids. And We were in for a humbling. In the first couple months that I worked there, there was a gentleman who passed away in his room. And it was really hard on me, but what actually broke my heart was to realize that he had lived there for 6 years, and of the 85 other residents in that building, I couldn't find one person who could tell me anything about him. Does he have a family? Where is he from? I couldn't find out anything. As all of this was happening, you could feel the darkness in the building, this feeling of people almost peering out their doors and thinking, that's what's going to happen to me. I'm going to die here alone, and it won't matter. No one will even notice. And so in that moment, I remember just feeling, understanding that I might not be able to fix the entire downtown east side with my big ideas, but we can fix this. We need to tackle the loneliness and the isolation that people are facing here. I should have prefaced this entire talk with, I was very honored to be asked to speak at this conference, because when Andy asked me, I was like, are you sure you got the right Jenny? I was like, I looked through the roster of speakers. I don't have any letters behind my name. I'm not some, doctor in theology. And but I was like, I'm in just because I want to hear all the other speakers and be a part of that. So it's pretty incredible. So as we go into this, I'm just going to share my journey with you of faith and how I came to understand. When we got down there, obviously we have a lot of resources in the downtown east side, and we started to see money being poured into things, and we can all read the homeless count every year. It's definitely never gone down. And so we wanted to see how can we actually make an impact. And those first 2 years, I had to really understand if we were going to tackle the problem, I had to find out what the root cause was. What is the root issue? Yes, we have a housing crisis, but we started to see we had a heart crisis. More than a housing crisis, we had to start looking at the heart and how can we help people heal. And so I was like, all right, well, what does the Bible say? How did Jesus help people heal? And I started to see this pattern. So I'm going to read a couple of verses that really helped me understand in Jesus' ministry, because I wanted to walk like Jesus, I want to act like Jesus, and I want to minister like Jesus. And so in Luke, when there's a widow who has just lost her son and she comes up weeping, and Luke 7:13 through 15 says, when the Lord saw her, he felt compassion for her and said to her, do not weep. And he came up and touched the coffin, and the bearers came to a halt. And he said, young man, I say to you, arise. The dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. So he saw her and he felt compassion for her, and then he healed the man. Matthew 20:34 says, moved with compassion, Jesus touched their eyes, and immediately they regained their sight and followed him. So he was moved with compassion, and then he healed. In Matthew 14:14, he went ashore, he saw a large crowd, and felt compassion for them, and healed their sick. So he saw the large crowd, he had compassion for them, and then he healed. And so I had to stop, and in those first 2 years before we started Holy House, I had to say, we have to see people. We have to see them as a person. And this is where I think in my faith I was really challenged to start loving people that I didn't always like. As I said, I work with murderers, I work with child molesters, I work with thieves, I work with people coming straight out of the prison system, people coming, you know, out of the streets, and they have negative outward behaviors. But I had to start to understand that every single person has a story. We start to hear stories of people who come out of foster care, 14 different foster homes before the age of 15 years old, abused in every single one of them, group homes, abusive parents, addiction in the home. And so as we saw this, it's really what ignited compassion inside of us to be able to love people. And so we're trying to figure out how are we going to help, and all these pieces are starting to come together. So first we have to see them and then have compassion on them. So as we get to know their stories and understand they're coming from a place of hurt. And again, I'll always tell people it's not an excuse for negative behavior, but it's an explanation. It helps me to understand where this is coming from. And so after, I will tell you, his name was Jean-Francois, the gentleman who passed away. I got to meet his family. They came from France and shared his story with me, which was devastating and difficult. He had isolated to the point that he only came out of his room in the middle of the night to go to 7-Eleven to get food. And they couldn't find a cause of death. So I truly believe he died of a broken heart in his bed alone. So We got to a point where we also recognized that we had to love people where they were at. If I want to build a relationship with you and I start pointing out, well, sir, your shirt's not quite right, and if you wore, you know, nicer shoes, we could probably hang out, but what kind of car do you drive? And I start putting all these conditions, you're going to start to back away from me and push me away. And so we started saying, we need this place to be very safe. We need people to feel comfortable to come here and just reconnect. We have to start with human connection. That is our deepest need as people. We need connection. And so in the same way that Jesus loved me first, and 1 John 4:19, we love because he loved us first. He didn't come to us and say, well, if you clean this up and clean that up and this, well, then I'll love you. But first you take care of that and then come back to me. That wasn't going to work because that's not how Jesus loved me. And so started to understand that we needed to start this program. And so I had no money, I had no funding, and I knew coming from a business background, I didn't want to start replicating things. If it was already out there, we were going to find them. If they were like-minded and same values, we wanted to partner with people and not have to spend more money and replicate. I'm a taxpayer. We see the amount of money that's going down there, and so we wanted to create programs that were impactful, but also that were resourceful. So I went and found there's this organization called Quest Food Exchange. And I was like, all right, perfect, we can get food. And first we started with a little games night, because if you live in an apartment building, how do you meet people, right? Especially hardened criminals. I'm going to knock on their neighbor's door and be like, hey, do you want to hang out tonight? Like, do you want to be my friend? Do you want to come over for a tea? Like, it doesn't really happen. So we had a games night, and we started inviting the guys down, and that was a good way, and we started connecting with them. And then I'm Italian, so of course, we have to eat together. And I knew this wasn't, we don't live in a developing nation. There's enough food in Canada, but the distribution and the nutrition was an issue for sure. So to me, it wasn't so much about the food, but it really was about the sitting down and eating together. And if I don't show up to family dinner on Sundays, my Nona is calling me and she's like, where are you doing? Your family's not important to you. And, you know, she's yelling. I knew I mattered in my family, right? So that even though you're getting yelled at, it makes you feel special because you know that someone cares about you. They notice if you're missing. So I go to Quest Food Exchange, and the warehouse manager is giving me a tour, and he's like, this is, you know, this. And he goes, actually, he's like, oh my goodness. I told him I had wanted to start a family dinner. He's like, I just got a huge donation in today. I don't have enough freezer space. I need to offload it. Maybe you could take some of it. And I was like, sure. I'm like, okay, well, but what is it? I'm scared he's going to give me some like weird food that I don't know how to cook. And he's like, well, it's tortellini. And I was like, I can work with tortellini. I'm like, okay, I got this. I'm like, and I really felt like, okay, God's got my back. He's walking with me. I'm not doing this alone. I for sure couldn't do this alone. So I've got the tortellini, and I came from, I used to work for Earls and their management and marketing department. So I made all the tables look really nice. I wanted the guys to feel so special, right? And like, my little touches, little flowers and stuff. And I've got the tortellini, I've got the garlic toast and the salad, because I'm a big believer in salad. I'm like, how do you make men eat salad? If you have tips, please leave them, write them down for me. So I've got everything prepared, and it's 3:45, and nobody's down. I was like, they're a bit shy, right? They're going to come a bit. And 3:55, still nobody's there. 4:00, now I'm mad. I'm like, I've been sleeping over a hot stove. Get your butts down here. So I go marching to turn the corner to go upstairs, and I'm gonna do my call, like my grandmother would yell for us, right? And I turn the corner, and there's a lineup of men holding their plates like they're going into a food lineup. And I was like, oh, I was like, no, okay, you guys, come on in. We're going to sit down. We're going to eat together. This is a family dinner. We're gonna connect. And it took a while for them to get used to that. We've built a culture of handouts, and I knew we didn't want to be a handout culture. We want to be a hand up culture. So from there, that family dinner, I started to learn that the guys wanted to contribute in order to rebuild their sense of purpose and value and dignity. That handout culture, and there are times in all of our lives where we need help. We need somebody to give to us. Yes, that's needed. But there is a time where you want to contribute. Every single one of us has gifts and talents that God gave to us. And when we don't get to use them, you don't feel that you have a purpose in life. And so obviously, we work with people with severe mental health issues, different levels of depression, anxiety, and so we'll see people sitting in their rooms all day long. And so after a family dinner, a guy would get up and be like, oh, I'll wipe the tables, and the next guy would get the broom and start sweeping, and that guy's doing the dishes. I'm like, oh, they want to help. And so I recognized we need to provide the opportunity. We're not going to force people. We weren't going to make them feel guilty if they didn't. But here it is. If you want to contribute, if you want to be a part of this, here's your opportunity. And so that was our next stage of rebuilding a sense of purpose and value and dignity. Actually, Chef David Robertson, has anybody ever been to the Dirty Apron downtown? It's an incredible first-class cooking school. You can often see him on the news. He's usually on Global. And he sits on my board of directors. And so he's got this beautiful cooking school. When you go there, I think the costs are about $180, but it's phenomenal. You get a four-course meal. And so he's like, Jen, we should do a cooking class. We'll bring the guys over. And I'm like, Dave, I'm like, I don't want you teaching them how to flambé, and then my building's going to burn down. I'm like, are you kidding? So I was like, but wait, this is a great idea. Cooking's really engaging. And, you know, when you create a beautiful meal, you feel so proud. And so I was like, well, what if we got crock pots? They're so safe. The guys can use them. And they're very like nostalgic, right? That home cooking feeling. And so he put a call out on the news and people donated crock pots. And we held this. We cooked beef bourguignon in a crock pot. And it was pretty incredible to see. And the guys were so proud. So they have a certificate. They're standing. They get their photo taken with the chef. They've made a beautiful meal that they can share with their neighbors. And so this program became so impactful in their lives. We started the Legacy Project, which I'll share with you a little bit about at the end, but these necklaces are all hand-stamped by gentlemen transitioning out of homelessness or coming out of recovery. And then after they make them, we sell them, and all the proceeds go back into their program. So now, one guy said to me, we were on breakfast television, and he goes, it's like, so I recognize, he's like, first of all, he said, I was so tired of disappointing people in my life. I'd failed so much throughout my life and disappointing myself. I stopped trying. He's like, I shut my door. I moved into the building. I shut my door. I didn't want to hear it. So for 1 year, I would hear her yelling in the hallways every Wednesday, family dinner, family dinner. He's like, shut the door. and then I would always ask him, I was like, Chris, you know, I miss seeing you at family dinner. I'd love to see you, or just kind of let him know, like, we would love to have him there. And so we're on TV, and thankfully I have long hair, and I was able to cover my tears because I couldn't believe what he said. And he's like, but she noticed if I wasn't there. He's like, I never mattered before. I was like, oh my God, I just make myself cry right now. But he didn't realize that he mattered. And so when he started doing the Legacy Project and stamping the necklaces, he's like, this gave me the opportunity to go slowly. They do it at their own pace. They're paid by the piece. So they're not working by the hour. They don't have to show up at a certain time. We have different levels of accountability that they can walk through. But we also have an oops bin. And I chose washers because they're affordable. If you make a mistake, that's okay. Toss it in the oops bin. Try again. And that really was that life lesson. Like, it's okay. Just try. Just try. And if you make a mistake, that's okay. There's another chance. And so we started that project, and he's like, so I realized after they sell these necklaces, he's like, I'm pretty much paying for family dinner. I was like, yeah. I was like, you're actually helping us fundraise so we can pay for family dinner. And he was so proud of that, right? Like, this is a guy who always had to get a handout, always had to wait in a food lineup. And now here he is helping us pay for the tortellini. Actually, I got the tortellini for free. So we ate that tortellini for almost a year. And I think at one point, guys were bringing me recipes. They're like, yeah, have you ever tried cooking? I'm like, yes, I know. So I try not to cook tortellini anymore. But it was pretty incredible to see. The third issue that we saw was a lack of a support network. So when you're living in isolation, maybe you've hurt your family or they've hurt you, you're now on your own, and say you do want to take a next step or you need help with something, who do you go to? So we have tenant support workers who walk alongside people, and whether that's this is how you get in touch with counseling, this is how you can apply at Union Gospel Mission, here we have a case manager who can get you in touch with a mental health worker, all these different support networks. Maybe it's just learning how to fill out your pension paperwork, or all these things that can be so confusing on a computer, through the system. We have a lot of different things in our system, and so thankful that we live in a country that has systems that we're able to access help, but it can be very difficult to navigate. I still can't do it. My team is amazing. I'm like, how do I fill this out? I'm like, what is Canada Pension Plan? So we have all these services to help become their support network. When someone's in the hospital, we go visit them. In fact, we started to see this incredible ripple effect when we started our program. So we branched out into our programs, and we started to see things that I never expected. I was like, this is what God meant when he said so much more than I could have ever asked or imagined, because I just wanted people to not die alone. That was my goal. I'm like, if someone can die knowing that they're loved, they're not alone, that was my goal. Well, now, instead of me going to the hospital 3 times a week, the guys are going, and they're taking a card, and they're visiting each other because they're friends. I'm like, how much better does that feel when your friend comes to the hospital to visit you, right, than a paid worker or somebody who, you know, that's incredible. And then when I first took over the building, we had 136 infractions. As the building inspector took me around, more than 90% of them were caused by tenants, whether it was through punching a hole in the wall, not letting us in to fix things, breaking things. By my fourth year, we had 3. The building inspector and the fire inspector both stood beside me, very tall men, had their one arm around each shoulder, and they're like, Jenny, what did you do? And I was like, loved people, gave them a home that they were proud of, that they felt dignified and respected. We practice unconditional love for the person. We have boundaries and rules. We set people up for success. We ensure that that's what they want to do, but we love the person unconditionally. I've had evictions where we both cry and hold each other and wish each other well and pray for people because the person still knows that they're loved, but there are boundaries and consequences to our actions, of course. One of the things that we also learned was I knew in order for change to happen, outward change to happen, that change on the inside had to happen, right? And so there was this one gentleman. Who every day something about him just really touched my heart. His name was Mark. He had longer, kind of white blonde hair. I would question if it had ever been washed. It had so many mats and food in it. He wore this puffy blue jacket, always food down his jacket, and he's definitely struggled with mental health issues. He would kind of shuffle down the hall every day, and so I'd see him walk by my office, like, hi, Mark, and he wouldn't look at me, but he would kind of, like, barely could hear his voice. And he came to our very first games night, which I was shocked, because you don't talk, so but I was like, great, I'm so happy you're here. And he played Jenga, and that was awesome, and then we had a music night, and he came out for that, and there was a conversation happening behind me, and I was like, oh, who is that? I don't know who that is. And it was this great little chat these guys were having. And I turn around, it's Mark. I was like, you talk? Like, you speak? I had no idea. So that was good. So he started getting involved, and then a couple weeks in, I'm sitting at my desk, and from where I sit, I can see the front doors, and I promise no word of a lie, it was like time slowed down into slow motion. His hair was so sparkling clean, it looked like a Pantene Pro-V commercial as he walks in. The wind is blowing it, and I'm like, huh. I'm like, oh my goodness, I almost didn't recognize that. So I jumped out of my desk and I go running up. I probably startled him a little bit because he was quite shy. And I, how do I ask? I don't want to offend him or embarrass him. I was like, Mark, you look great today. I was like, what's different? Did you go to the barber shop? And he's like, no, I took a shower this morning. And he's like, we have games night tonight, right? And I was like, yes, Mark, we have games night tonight. And he had a reason to get ready and to take care of himself, to respect himself. He was going to see his friends. And it was just something so small. I could have gone to Mark every day for 2 years and told him to take a shower, and he wouldn't listen. His mental health workers told him every day to take a shower, and he didn't listen. It was from the inside out, feeling loved and belonging and community. One of the other things often I'll hear, especially working in nonprofit, is, yeah, but what are your numbers? How many guys got jobs? And how, you know, and I really understand that this is a long-term game that we're in. We're in it for the long haul, and change takes time. I know it did in my life. It still takes time in my life. And so there's this one gentleman who lived in the building since 1986. So I knew him even when I was a little girl, and I remember my grandfather taking us to the buildings on the weekends. He'd be fixing something, and we'd be running around. And so his name was Mike, and Mike was a First Nations gentleman, and he struggled really badly with alcoholism. When he was sober, he was so kind, but when he would leave for the bar at 9 a.m., come back by 2 or 3 in the afternoon, he'd be yelling at me, spitting at me, you know, every word in the book, and I'm just sitting at my desk, and I remember one time calling my brother when it first happened. I was like, why is he so mean to me? Like, what did I do? And I'm like, just trying to help. But Mike ended up having a surgery on his arm, and so he was sober for a couple of weeks. He couldn't really get out at all. He was kind of homebound. And so in the morning, the gentleman had wanted to start a coffee program. I was like, great. I'm like, that's phenomenal. I'm like, I'm not coming here at 6 a.m., so who's going to run the coffee program? And it was this great opportunity for somebody to volunteer. So we had this young gentleman he offered. And so he was making the coffee in the morning, and Mike was sitting there. And Mike is being a cranky old man and just criticizing him. I was like, I'm listening from my office. I'm like, oh, man, he's so mean. And he's just like, why are you doing it like that? No, you're gonna wreck it. And he's just going on and on. And the young man was very smart, and he just stood back. He goes, uncle. He's like, I would really appreciate if you would teach me since you know so much more than I do. And so Mike's like, well, I'll show you this one time, but you better just learn how to do it right. And I don't want to drink that coffee. And, you know, he's going on. And so I was like, all right, cool. So Mike makes the coffee. And then the next day he comes back down, does it again. By the end of the week, he's at my office door. He's like, I'm going to need more of the sanitation stuff because I like cleaning the kitchen. If I'm going to work in the kitchen, it's going to be clean. It's like, and also we're saving this toast, this beautiful toast coming from the bakery. He's like, why don't we have any peanut butter? We need peanut butter. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like making a list. Like, he's my boss. I'm like, all right, okay. And eventually we get him his own key. He has his own cupboard. He nicknamed himself Coffee Mike, which was adorable. He's down there at 7 a.m. every single morning, 7 days a week, prepping the kitchen, getting everything laid out. Incredible. Every day he would come by my office and tell me the same list. Okay, I'm going to need coffee mate, sugar, peanut butter, jam. And I'm like, yeah, okay, pretending to write something down. I'm like, I know the list. I've got it. But he was so proud. This was his job, right? And he was responsible for it. And so he's telling me his list. And then he goes to walk away. He's like, okay, I love you too. And I was like, okay, I love you too. I'm like, but it was just this, like, all of a sudden this change. I'm like, this man who used to raise his cane at me, you know? After his first 2 weeks, I remember this young woman came through the front door and I saw her talking to my staff and she looked all distressed. And I'm like, so I go up there and I'm like, hi, I'm like, can I help you? And she's like, yeah. She's like, I haven't been able to find Mike and I don't know where he is and I'm not sure if he passed away. And I was like, sorry, who are you looking for? And she's like, Mike. And I was like, oh. I was like, yeah, no, he's here. He's just making coffee in the back. She's like, oh my gosh, I thought he was dead. And I was like, I'm sorry, who are you? And she's like, I'm his bartender. And I was like, oh my goodness. I was like, get out of here. I'm like, shooing her out the door. Like, you scoot out the door. So it was pretty incredible to see that all it took was for him to have this purpose. He had a reason and people thanked him. And hey, Mike, thanks for making the coffee. Did he become perfect? Absolutely not. Did he drive me crazy? For sure. Almost every day. But he had this transformation on the inside. He was so proud. When he passed away, only a few short years after Jean-Francois, who passed away, the room was full. We had to get more chairs. We prayed. We had the opportunity to pray over all the residents there. It was incredible to see that someone died completely alone, and now we have this supportive, healthy community who are taking care of each other, not becoming more reliant on systems, but really being empowered. And now they're here to honor somebody's life. Nobody's dying and it doesn't matter. It matters. Your life matters. We value you. There's dignity for you. I just loved his speech about dignity and just seeing people. We have to see people, look people in the eyes and understand that they have a story. Whether you're homeless or going through addiction or you're a housewife or it doesn't matter. All of us have pain and we've gone through something and that's how we're able to have compassion. And Jesus obviously showed that to us, that he came down here and did what we do so that we're able to know he can have compassion for us. He knows what I'm going through. And so at the end of the day, pain is pain. We also started to see more ripple effect in our housing. So again, things I never planned for, our housing stabilized to the point that BC Housing took notice and said, what are you doing? Like, what's going on here? Well, how come people are staying housed? The housing, the cycle of homelessness is so fast. The normal process is someone is homeless, either on the street or in a shelter, and there's an outreach worker working so hard on their behalf, applying for them into different housing societies. And this person finally gets housing. Joe is going to get housing. Great. Joe moves in and nothing has changed on the inside of Joe. He now has a room and a bed. Whether it's his behavior or somebody else's behavior or he gets evicted because of issues, that cycle goes very quickly. Generally, within 2 months, somebody is back on the street and the process starts all over again. Our people were staying housed because they had a community to connect into. They had a place of belonging. I remember one gentleman telling me, he's like, I had this weird moment last night. And I was like, what? And he's like, I was laying on my bed. And he's like, I got home and I just laid on my bed. I was watching a sitcom and I just started laughing. And he's like, it was just something silly on TV, whatever it was. And he's like, I never felt normal before. It's like I just had this moment where I was like, I'm normal. I'm just a guy hanging out, watching TV, and I, like, this is my home. This is my home. I feel normal. And I was just like, oh my goodness. And I can't imagine to not know what that feels like, to not know what it feels like to have a home, a place where you belong. And so we started to see this stabilization. BC Housing offered us funding, and so we now have full funding for our staffing, which is incredible. Thank you, Jesus. All of, as I said before, everything, all the programs that I created, I knew I had to build trust with people. And so in order to do that, I had to be consistent, not cancel programs. So every time I created a program, it had to be sustainable, financially feasible, because if I canceled because I don't have money today, then we were breaking trust all over again. And so all of our programs we run are extremely, either we partner with other people or very, very affordable because we want to be sustainable. So we do fundraise for our programs, but again, it's, I'm a terrible fundraiser. I'm like, we don't even, my dream in life would be to have nonprofits that don't need money because we have great partnerships. It would be incredible, and that's the entrepreneur in me, and that's where I'm headed. But we really, you know, our lawyer came alongside us when we got started, and I said, God, I don't know what I'm doing. I've never started a charity. I have no idea how to do this. I'm like, I run a restaurant, no problem. I can run circles around everybody. I was great at it. I was like, start a charity? How do I do that? And I just remember him impressing on my heart, just say yes, and I'm going to do this with you every step of the way. I've got it. And the tortellini, that was like a moment there. I was like, oh, I'm like, okay, God, you really are doing this with me. A friend who went to high school with my brother became a big fancy lawyer, and she's like, hey, let me get all your registration work done for you. To this day, we have not paid one lawyer's fee. She has done all of our work pro bono. Our accountant, same thing. I've never paid a penny towards an accountant. All of the work is pro bono. So as we partner with people, especially other believers, so many people come and offer their gifts and talents. We're able to get so much more done. We also partner with Union Gospel Mission. So imagine not knowing what you're doing. The president of Union Gospel Mission sits on my board of directors and personally mentors me and helps me understand. He'll be in our board meetings and be like, well, section 4A of the code. And we're like, oh, yes, okay, yes. Yeah, I knew that. Yeah, Bill. Totally. He's so smart. He used to be the CFO for the Salvation Army as well. So many years of knowledge and experience that I just get to soak in. And I was like, God, so faithful just to surround me with people who know what they're doing and know how to control an Italian. So that's really good. But really, it's been an incredible walk of faith. But along the way, in those times where you start to get discouraged, if you drive down Hastings and Maine every day, believe me, there are days I get discouraged. Those numbers are not going down; they are growing. And so it really takes those moments of remembering what the Lord has done and knowing He'll do it again and again. And I remember one time I did get very discouraged. I just remember thinking, this is crazy. Like I'm working in craziness. This is chaos. And I just remember just in prayer and being in that moment, the Lord saying, but think about Mark. You made a difference to that one. Think about Duncan. You made a difference to that one. Think about Chris. You made a difference to that one. And I had to see, go back to the basics and see the people. I couldn't look at the problem and this big issue that we're facing, but I had to see the people and know their stories. One gentleman who I know, this was my, I think, one of my biggest examples of learning how to love people that we don't like. And actually like him as a person, really friendly, nice guy, but I knew his history and I knew that he had murdered a police officer. That was so hard for me to think, how am I helping you right now? How, you know, and it was so difficult. And I just remember in that moment, now knowing where he's at, he got off the system. He went back to Edmonton to live with his sister, was able to reconnect with his family on medications. There was a whole complicated story behind it, but it was so incredible to see that someone who has this life is pretty much condemned, was able to rebuild and have a productive life and have purpose and have love. He still phones me all the time. I'm like, that was a murderer. I just talked on the phone to a murderer. And thinking how crazy that is, but I'm like, that's a person I truly love. And to see how far he's come is obviously only by the grace of God. And that's what we got to see, is that as we're showing people that we love them, I work with people who often have felt either abandoned by God or hurt by God or the person who represented God to them or the church that represented God. We work with obviously a lot of people coming out of residential schools. The abuse, the amount of sexual abuse in general that are in the downtown east side, people who have suffered through that is astronomical. I would venture to say most of the men that we work with have been traumatized by sexual abuse. And so when we're able to understand that, and that's where this trauma comes from and has led to different decisions in their lives, that compassion comes out. But also to understand that I can't walk in with an agenda that I'm trying to fix you. I'm going to fix you and I'm going to do this. It really, truly came from a place of unconditional love. And only through that, that transformation on the inside was able to happen. I also had to have a lot of faith that God would give me opportunities to share his love, to share the gospel. And so we partner with my church. I go to Coastal Church downtown and other churches we partner with. And guess what? Christian volunteers are amazing because you build relationships and that's organic and it's real. And then they get to know you and they get to, oh, you go to this church. Oh, what is that like? And we get to share the gospel in that way. I had a guy one time pacing outside of my office door. And I was like, what's going on? So I was like, hey, John, how's it going? What's up? He's like, oh, I'm really anxious. I'm not feeling good today. I'm like, why? What's happening? He's like, well, I got to go to court tomorrow. My parole's almost up. I've worked really hard. I don't know. I'm like, okay. I'm like, you know what? And so he came and kind of shared his story with me. And I was like, when I feel anxious, you know, I pray. I was like, it's the only thing that I usually find peace in. That's where I can have some rest. And I was like, can I pray for you? And he said, you know, he's all tough, right? He's prison. And he's like, well, yeah, the big guy probably hears you more than he listened to me. So sure. Okay. And I was like, okay. So I prayed for him. I just, simple prayer that he would do well, that he, you know, speak well and that he would be able to share his story. And he came back the next day and it was like a kid coming home from school who had drawn a picture or something. He's like, the prayer thing worked. The prayer thing worked. I was like, I know, prayer works. And he was just so excited. He had worked so hard and stayed within his parole and done so well. He's like, all right, you can keep doing it. And I was like, I do. I'm like, every day I pray for you. And he's like, okay. And I had so many opportunities to sit down with him and talk with him and just share the love of Jesus with him. And so I knew if I tried to do it in my own timing and my own ways, that I was going to mess it up. So I really still always so reliant on God. I'm like, I know that he has to do this work. I can't heal people's hearts. In my moment of surrender, I remember that moment and just be like, God, and the list of things I knew I needed to change and fix and habits I needed to break. And God just said, no, just give it to me. Come as you are. And so we wanted to take that model, come as you are, and that change will start to happen from the inside out. And so, as I said, we now work at the Veterans Manor. We serve 133 veterans and seniors who had no support services in their building. I was actually quite ashamed to I didn't know that we had so many seniors and veterans who were at risk of homelessness or coming out of homelessness and without any support. So what we're seeing now is this trend. Our homeless count just came out last year. 23% of our homeless population in Metro Vancouver are seniors. That's shocking. One study shows that 90% of them became homeless after the age of 60. So I was like, well, no, that's not okay. When we got to this building, we found out that seniors were being targeted at the bank on pension day. And so everything rose up in me. And I was like, uh-uh, that's not happening. We're not having seniors being taken advantage of, vulnerable seniors who are already scared to go outside in our neighborhood. So I was like, we're rallying. And then my fundraising thing came out and me like, we're getting a van and we're going to go with them to the bank. Most people want to keep their independence. These gentlemen have their bank books. I'm like learning what a bank book is. But they want to go to the bank. They want to, you know, do that and keep that. So we want them to do it in a safe way. I don't want to take away everyone's abilities to do things. We want to empower people, right? So we got a van. Actually, BC Housing matched the VP of BC Housing came and did a tour, which was shocking because he doesn't come to the buildings. Came and did a tour. I shared our story. He welled up with tears. I was in shock. I was like, oh my goodness. And he was like, we're going to help you get a van. I was like, okay. And I was like, you're housing. They don't usually do vehicles. So that was phenomenal. So we fundraised. We got our van. We do a bank trip every month on pension day. We take them all to their banks and they've got their bank books. We implemented different support services. Obviously working with seniors, we want to ensure their health and their safety, but also programs. So they're coming out of their rooms. How do I know if that person's healthy if I never see them? We also, you know, we have exercise classes and smoothies on Thursdays. I'll tell you the secret of how you get men to eat spinach. You stick it in a smoothie. It's delicious. So we have a smoothie program. Actually, the gentlemen who are coming out of recovery from Union Gospel Mission, from drug and alcohol recovery, come and they serve the smoothies. They make the smoothies. And it's part of their 12 steps. It's part of their recovery process and giving back. So they also make these necklaces. So these necklaces, as I said, all the proceeds go to support that. My dad, when he was first diagnosed with cancer, they gave him, as I said, 4 months to live. After that, he lived for another 4.5 years and healthy, and he fought it, and he was amazing. I wish you all could meet him. But he passed away Christmas Day in 2013. And he used to say, he was like, all those things I used to complain about. He's like, oh, I have to wait in line at the bank. Oh, I got to clean my garage. He's like, no, I get to clean my garage today. He's like, I'm still alive. I still can. That's a privilege. That's not an obligation. So I wanted to carry on his message and his legacy. And so we started this project. As I said, I got the washers so that they could make mistakes. It's okay. And then we have a gold and silver line as well. Those are downstairs. But the guys are so proud. They're so proud to make these necklaces. They'll come and tell me, like, oh, yesterday, he's like, this guy at the recovery center kept saying, he's like, oh, I have to do this. He's like, no, man, you get to. And they tell other people about it. So it's pretty incredible. This gentleman was in prison. Did I tell you this? No, okay. Sorry, now I just mixed up the last session. He was in prison, I believe it was for 17 years, in and out of prison, sorry, for 17 years. And he moved into our building and he said, Jenny, I don't want to go back. I don't. And so he started stamping necklaces and he came to me and he goes, this keeps me busy. He's like, I'm proud. My mom is proud of me. And he has become one of our star stampers, now has full-time work, continues stamping as well. And he even did a little video for us that's on our website sharing his testimony about being in prison. But it was just incredible. When he first came to me, I knew the type of trauma that he had suffered as a child. And so we partnered with a counseling service. We paid for his first 3 counseling sessions. He did so well and wanted to work so hard that they said, we have our practicum students here that are counseling. $5 a session. He pays it himself and he goes every single week. He still continued. He just finished parole last week and is so excited to be back part of the community and really contributing and living a productive life. So he's amazing. So if you think of Lee, just pray for him. And he's been with us now for, I think, 3 years, which is pretty incredible. So as I said, we're now at the Veterans Manor. That's our ministry there, is to work with people who don't have support systems in place so we can prevent them from becoming homeless. And so we're super blessed and thankful to do that. We're working right now with BC Housing on a proactive, because I really love how we're all so reactive. So I was like, let's be proactive. We see that elderly people are becoming homeless for these reasons. What if we get in there and support them so that those reasons don't happen? And so we're working on that right now as well so that we can replicate our programs. In the last year and a half, we had a 97% retention rate as people move in, not becoming homeless again. So that to me was like, none of that had I ever thought of. I just didn't want people to die alone. We now hold a celebration of life service for every single person who passes away, especially with veterans. We do their ceremonial things that go along with when a veteran passes away. We were able to get our 98-year-old World War II veteran, his medals that he never received from Veterans Affairs, and hold a service for him. I was able to minister to his daughter and walk through the process of forgiveness with her because they had a very rocky childhood. He had schizophrenia that went undiagnosed. And so it's just incredible to see the things that God has done when we're able to have compassion for people. So thank you so much. I really appreciate being here. And if you have any questions, please do let me know. Thank you. Yeah, I just found that this lady worked in the downtown east side as well. So very.
She came after me.
Mm-hmm. This was
absolutely unbelievable change.
Yeah. So I honestly feel honored and proud that we get to support people who I was so blessed to come from a good home, and I see the tools and the opportunities I was given, and I believe God calls us to use those to help others who don't have that. So yeah. Yeah. Does anybody
She's been to Uganda.
I have been to Uganda, yes. Twice. Love Uganda. Does anybody have any questions? I know it can be an awkward thing to ask questions about the downtown East Side. Yeah.
So do you just wait for the random opportunities to pray with people and stuff, or has there been opportunity to actually do a little Bible study or do something?
Yes. So in our first building, we started going to Alpha. So there's a our church was local, and we started going to Alpha. So we had a group of guys. Alpha season ended, and they were like, "Well, now what?" And I was like, "Well, you know, we can go again." And they're like, "Well, no, why can't we just do it here? Can't we just have a Bible study?" And like, "Yeah, whatever you want to call it." And I was like, "Okay." So we did a Bible study. Our van now goes to church every Sunday. So anybody who wants to come to church, we have a great little community there. And then also they know, so we're not a religious organization, we're a registered Canadian charity. And we did that on purpose because we recognize how many people wouldn't walk through the doors of UGM, wouldn't go into a church. So we wanted to be that bridge and the gap there. But now that they know us, then we have those opportunities and that one-on-one time. Also, Celebration of Life is a really good opportunity that we get to pray with people, or if they're in the hospital, we do hospital visits. And that's always a great opportunity to just share and pray together. But we definitely, the church van opportunity was such, that was such a blessing, because there are so many people who do want to go to church, didn't know how to get there, or don't want to go alone, right? That's kind of scary to do. So yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What kind of workshops are done by volunteers?
So anything from our family dinners, our smoothie program, we have birthday parties every month. And then we also have a clean team, which we always tell people is not for the faint of heart. We will go in and actually like deep clean a senior's room. Somebody who has disabilities aren't not able to clean for themselves. Sometimes it's a bit of a light clean. We go and do their kitchen and bathroom and sweep and mop. Other times we've done like scrubbing the walls, like 20 years of smoke. And it can be really harsh, but it's one of the fastest leading ways that people get evicted, is because they'll get pests and rodents and not able to care for themselves anymore. We have afternoon outings. We have a seated exercise class. One of the most fun things is family dinner, just because we serve the food, but then we all go sit down and eat together too, so it's really fun. And then if we have groups who come in, sometimes it'll be on different times, so we set up like a coffee, and every morning, or three mornings a week, we have coffee. We have a games and bingo. We have a movie matinee. So all different types of things. And when someone comes to volunteer with us, I'm supposed to repeat the question into this little secret microphone. When somebody comes to volunteer, we do an orientation, so that most people haven't spent any time in the downtown east side. We want you to understand and feel comfortable. We go through what it's like. We do a tour of the building, but also just how do we interact with people. One of my biggest things, I'm like, don't be weird. Often people will come in and just be like, hello, God bless you. You know, you're like, no, that's a grown man. Let's treat him with respect and dignity, and with all, of course, the best of intentions. But we really want to share with people that this is a person who has dignity and respect, and so we want to treat them that way. And so, you know, how was the Canucks game last night? Or how do we start conversations? And we go through things like that. And then we go through safety and all the precautions that we take. I will tell you, it has been incredible. We have never had one instance of violence, which is just mind-boggling. I pulled a 911 report. The 911 operator was like, I've never done this before. So I gave him four different buildings in our neighborhood around us. And this was in the first building we were in. And he's like, I can't differentiate if they're, you know, police, fire, ambulance, but here's your report. And he called me back when he got the report. He's like, what is this building? He's like, why is it so different? Our average calls to 911 per year was 24. The surrounding buildings were 250. 250 calls to 911 per year, and we were at 24. Everybody was asking, what are you doing? I was like, love people, give them respect, dignity, and set up a system that sets them up for success to walk alongside them. So, yeah.
So how do people get to live in...
Mm-hmm. Great question. How do people get to live in one of our buildings? So the Veterans Manor is owned and operated by the Veterans Memorial Housing Society. And then we work with BC Housing with the Supportive Housing Registry. So what BC Housing tries to do is get everybody on a centralized wait list. Otherwise, you've got, you know, Joe walking in off the street and applying for a room, and then he gets it before somebody who's been waiting for a year. And so we take off the wait list. If somebody walks in, we'll help them fill in their application form. And then when a room comes open, then we pull from the wait list. We do an interview. It's not abstinence-based housing, so there are people who use in our building who do struggle with addiction. And the qualifications for this building are 55+, and veterans do get priority if they're the right fit. And then they have to be the right fit for the building. We don't want to put people in a building where they're going to get evicted quickly or leave, or we want to make sure that they're going to remain housed. Actually, our retention rate last year was 97%. So it's really important to us that we don't create one more opportunity for failure. And yeah, so just application and then finding the right building for them.
Because I work for a prison ministry.
Oh, wow.
Yes. FPW2 Association.
Okay.
So I'm sure many of the guys.
Yeah. I sat in on a Corrections Canada forum where they were asking us, how do we help people find housing? So I'll give you my card. Yeah, absolutely. It's shocking. I didn't know. I had a gentleman show up at our doorstep, and He's like, I have $12. I just got out of prison. I don't know where to go. And I was like, oh my goodness. So thank you for your ministry because it's definitely needed. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you do any arts or music?
We had arts in our last building. When we got to this building working with seniors, we have some pretty like rough guys, and they just weren't having it. They were like, no, this isn't our thing. But music, they have enjoyed. Sometimes we'll have people come in and perform or do little music nights, and definitely enjoyed, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Time's up. I'm going to get my red card. I'm here, and I'm happy to stay and answer any questions if you have any questions. Or downstairs at the booth, we have all of our necklaces or any information about Holy House that you would like. We would love to see you. If you ever want to come down, please let me know. I'd love to give you a tour, and you can see what's going on.
Stamped on the necklaces.
So this one says, I get to, or I am. And then you can choose whatever word you like to go with it. So I get to give, I get to love, I get to, yeah. Yeah, so awesome. You guys enjoy the rest of the conference, and thank you so much.